Hello and welcome to another jam-packed episode of Wellness with Lizelle. And today it's a real cracker. And it's such a pleasure actually to be joined by Dr. Shazadi Harper. Now, Shazadi is a London-based GP specialising in women's well-being and is so passionate about optimal hormonal health so that we can all feel confident and sexy, whatever our age. So much to chat about. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what's fascinating talking to you is that it's not just when you're looking at hormonal health and the menopause in particular, it's not just older women. You were telling me earlier, just before we started recording, that for many cultures, it starts very much earlier. I mean, you have an Indian background, is that right?
I have a Pakistani background, but one of the things is I think that people always think of sort of postmenopausal or menopausal women as being sort of silver-haired, wearing slacks, running on the beach. But actually, I believe that you need to start thinking about your hormones from the age of 40 onwards. And the average age of menopause in India is 46 and a half. And they're very...
Of actual menopause, so that's actual periods stopping.
Actual period stopping. Similarly, here in this country, the average age is 51, but in India, it's 46 and a half. So, you know, I think we need to think about it sometimes from different ethnic backgrounds, that people may have slightly different ages of menopause. And I think we need to really be aware of our hormones, probably a bit earlier rather than later, so we can do something about them.
Well, I know you were telling me that Oprah refers to the over 35, is that right?
She does, she does. You know, she's very much talking about over 35, starting to look at your hormonal profile and possibly going to see your doctor about whether or not you need any interventions, whether it be lifestyle or medication, you know, lots of different types of interventions that can happen and just discussing it with your doctor. Mm. Yes.
So for you, why women's health? Why did you decide to specialise in that?
Well, I'm one of six girls in my family. I've got five younger sisters.
Good heavens, you must have felt like head girl.
I was, definitely. I really was. I mean, and they all look up to me, being their big sister. I've also got a 21-year-old daughter, so very much aware of her hormonal needs as well. And my mother, who's a really strong, intelligent woman, when she went through the menopause, I saw the way that she had a meltdown. And actually, she now suffers with dementia. So for me, I was really passionate about finding out more about it, because I think that one of the things is maybe if she had had some kind of hormonal treatment, maybe her dementia may not have been as bad as it is now. So it really kind of sparked a passion in me. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as I'm growing older, you know, I still wanted to feel good and look good.
You look amazing. And we will be putting pictures on our podcast notes
if you
want to check out this curiously gorgeous GP I'm talking to.
Yeah. So for me, it was very much an interest. And I thought, as a junior GP, when women in their 40s used to come and see me, sort of, I used to think, I really don't want to end up in that kind of state that they were in.
What sort of problems were they presenting?
Tiredness, you know, sort of hot night sweats, hot flushes, aches and pains, sort of symptoms that they couldn't really put their finger on. And neither could I really, other than thinking, are they going through the menopause or the perimenopause? And I thought, you know, and I didn't really know what to do about it, because we don't get trained at medical school.
That's quite a shocking thing, isn't it?
That absolutely.
Every single woman, if she lives long enough, and from what we're hearing now, it may not actually be older age, it's happening really right in the middle of the early onset of middle age, it's going to happen to all of us, and therefore that's half your surgery.
Yeah, I mean,
why are you not being trained in that?
I mean, I really don't know. I mean, there are 3.5 billion women in the world. You know, irrespective of them having children or not, we're all going to go through the menopause at some point. You know, there are 11 million women over the age of sort of 44 who are going through this process in the UK. And I think, you know, we're
11
not...
million in the UK.
11 million in
Can
the
you imagine if we all got together, girls? What would we look like? I mean, the noise that we could make and the stories we could share.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, we as GPs don't even get sort of an hour's lecture on it. Well, I didn't when we were training for it. So I really felt I needed to find out more about it myself. And I thought, with it approaching for me and also for my younger sisters, I thought I wanted to know more.
So how did you find out as a GP? Because you've done all your training.
So I had this unfortunate event in sort of 2014 that I tore my cruciate ligament.
Oh,
and so I was laid up in bed and I thought, where am I going with my life?
Mm.
And at that point in time, I had thought about maybe leaving the NHS. I felt a little bit burnt out. But the truth is, you know, I became a doctor because I really wanted to help people. And that's where my passion lies, and particularly women. So I started to look into what courses I could do. I looked at nutrition. I looked at, you know, aesthetics. So And then I think I just hit upon this course on menopause, and I went to it, and I thought this was really something I wanted to find out more and more about. And now I'm a member of the British Menopause Society, the European Menopause and Andropause Society. You know, I've done lots of sort of research into it, finding out more, attending lots of lectures and things, because I'm really hungry for knowledge and to share it with people and to put things into perspective, because I think there's a lot of scare stories out there.
Well, I think we should probably take that head on before we talk about anything else, because we will be talking about hormonal health and all sorts of types of hormones, including hormone replacement therapy, HRT. Presumably the number one question that you get asked by women coming in, if you're going to suggest HRT, is, ah, yes, but what about breast cancer?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not going to deny that it doesn't increase your risk of breast cancer, but I think we really need to put it into perspective. When we talk about the risk of breast cancer and we say that 1 in 8 women will develop breast cancer, we are talking about over a lifetime of a woman. Mm. We're not talking at a specific point in their life. So a woman in her 20s, her risk is going to be more like 1 in 1,100, whereas a woman who's in her 60s probably will have a much higher risk of breast cancer. So when we talk about that, I think we also forget the other factors that happen. So a woman, when she starts on HRT, let's talk about sort of at the average age of 51, the baseline risk of developing breast cancer is 23 in 1,000 women over 5 years will get it. A woman who's on HRT, will her risk increases by 4, so it becomes 23 plus 4. However, if you are an obese woman, irrespective of you being on HRT, your risk is 23 plus 30.
Oh my goodness. So we must not let that muffin top get to us.
No, and that muffin top...
I mean, our
top,
risk factor for breast cancer is very much being overweight.
Yes, I think the biggest risk factor is obesity more than anything else. Mm. So why are we denying women a better quality of life based on if they want to go on to HRT after they have been informed and they consent to it? Why are we denying them that just because we are talking about breast cancer, when actually what we should be saying to them is, why not lose some weight? Why not take some exercise?
Yeah.
Because exercise, if you are somebody who exercises regularly, and we're talking about half an hour a day of moderate exercise or 75 minutes per week of vigorous exercise, your risk then reduces by 23 minus 7 over a 5 year. So if you are a healthy, fit woman who doesn't drink alcohol, you know, sort of more than 2 glasses a night, every single night, if you don't smoke, if you exercise regularly and stay trim, then actually your risk of breast cancer is low. So if you're on HRT, then yes, it will increase your risk, but not in the ways that the papers are scaring you.
The sensational. And I know through writing my book, The Good Menopause Guide, that the big study that came out 10, 12 years ago was wildly misinterpreted and exaggerated. And that actually put a lot of women off, and actually, to be fair, put a lot of GPs off prescribing it, didn't it?
Well, a lot of doctors stopped prescribing because, you know, one, as I mentioned before, we're not really that well informed on the whole.
Yeah.
And so I think when you have a scare story like that, you are going to stop because you don't want to put women at risk.
No, sure.
But those studies that came out in 2001, 2002 were on older women. The average age of a woman in those studies was 59, 60. We're talking about women... we're talking about the window of opportunity. There's a window of opportunity to start HRT, which is around the time that they go through the perimenopause transition. So maybe from 45 onwards, that if a woman is put onto HRT at that point, then really her risks are not significantly reduced. And even now we're talking about there may be some positive benefits, particularly around cardiovascular disease.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? The studies that I've seen show that taking HRT can halve your risk of coronary heart disease.
Absolutely. If we look at men and women in their lifetime, men always have a higher risk of cardiovascular disease than women until the age of about 50, 51, 52. At that age, women's risks level off to the same as men. The only thing that I can think of that changes around that time is menopause.
It's hormones, yeah.
So the fact is, our hormones, our female hormones, are protecting us against a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. So if we stay on hormones, or if we choose to be on hormones, then maybe, you know, over time, more and more studies will come out to show that actually it's protective.
Protective. And osteoporosis, bone health, because that must be a big thing that you see in your clinics.
Oh, bone health. I mean, particularly you start to lose sort of bone mass density from sort of the age of 40 onwards.
And why is that? Why do we suddenly lose it?
Hormones.
Is it there?
It's hormones.
Everything's
coming
back to hormones.
You know, obviously if you're a smoker or if you drink alcohol.
That affects your bones?
Yes.
Oh, gosh, I thought it was just your lungs.
No, smoking has a huge impact, actually, and sort of alcohol has a huge impact, you know, lack of exercise.
Yes, I'm aware of it having to do bone strengthening, so weight bearing, even walking actually is good for your bones, isn't it?
And the other thing is, I mean, funnily enough, you know, I suppose we're all really self-conscious about our sort of image. So if you are somebody who's quite a really thin woman, then your estrogen levels are going to tend to be a bit lower. And
Are they?
You're going to end to be, and you're going, because fat naturally produces estrogen.
Oh, so we need a bit of fat.
We do. And
Excellent.
This may be one of the reasons why our body changes shape around the time of the menopause, because as our hormonal levels fluctuate.
Yes.
And I don't want to be stealing your thunder here, Liz, talking about weight, but I'm just saying one of the things is that as our hormonal levels fluctuate, our body's trying to create more estrogen.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons is I think that what happens is we end up getting fatter because fat is trying to create more estrogen in our bodies to sort of bump up the levels of estrogen.
That's so interesting, because I have read that we make our hormones from fat.
We do.
And therefore, one of the last things that we should be doing, especially in our mid or later life, is going on a low-fat diet and cutting out the good fats that are going to give us the building blocks to make good hormones.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we shouldn't be sort of cutting out sort of good fats from our diet. You know, we should be cutting out things like sugar.
Sure.
Okay. And we should be cutting down on carbohydrates around this time, because those are the things that then lay down more and more sort of unhealthy sort of fat around the middle and weight, and causing things like, and because of our hormonal changes, we end up having a little bit more what we call insulin resistance. And so
what does that mean in practice?
What that means is it becomes harder for us to lose weight.
That is a real thing, because I mean, people do say that they put on more weight or find it much harder to shift it.
Yeah, I mean, the studies show that women gain about 5 to 10 kilograms around sort of the menopause transitional year. So over sort of 5 to 8 years that their hormones are changing, and until the point that they finally stop their periods, they do tend to put on about 5 to 10 kilograms. And I often say to women around this time, look at what you're eating and maybe cut down on the carbs and increase the protein aspect, because what we want our body to do is to burn off our fat rather than store it, because our bodies love to use sugar as energy. So when we're eating carbohydrates, it will naturally burn off the carbs and create sort of energy from the sugars, rather than burning off the fat that our body's laying down.
So, I mean, I've taken HRT for probably 18 months now, and actually I've watched my weight go down. And I think that's because, this is a personal reflection, I'd be interested to see your view on this medically, I am more active, I have more energy, I sleep better for longer, and I have more energy, I go out running now, whereas that was never something that I did before.
I think there's a number of factors involved here. I think a lot of women aren't sleeping well when they are going through the menopause. You know, they are also feeling low in mood as well. They're feeling lacking in energy, so they don't feel as motivated to go out and do exercise. The other thing our hormones are also doing is changing our body shape from sort of what we would call a gynoid, as in a womanly shape, to a more android, a more rotund shape. So we'd end up with the fat around the middle.
So that sort of middle-age spread people talk
Absolutely.
About, that's a real thing,
That's a real thing. So when we go on to HRT, our hormones become better balanced. So what happens is we then go back to that natural shape. And actually, I mean, a lot of my patients, what they find is, although they may not have lost weight by going on to HRT, but what they found is that their shape is coming back. You know, they've got the hourglass coming back. And they've said to me that their partners, their husbands, have noticed that their shape has changed. And that makes them feel more like a woman again. Mm. And you're absolutely right as well. They do have more energy. They're sleeping better. So they're feeling more motivated. Their self-esteem is better because they're looking better. Mm. And so off they go out and sort of exercise, or you know, maybe less comfort eat as well.
Yeah, exactly. Not feeling so low that you're holed up on the sofa with a box of dairy milk.
Well, for me, it's croissants, but yes. Okay.
Did you ever feel low? Did you? Because you're sort of in your late 40s now. So what's your own personal experience? Which I think is relevant as a GP, because you are very much in the same stage as a lot of women who are coming to see
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I lost my father about sort of 2.5 years ago. And I did kind of wallow in croissants at that point and gain weight. And I noticed that I was feeling really fatigued. So I made a conscious decision to go on to hormones myself.
At what age when you did that?
I was 45 at the time.
So that fits in with NICE guidelines. That's what NICE guidelines say, 45.
Yeah, but nothing had changed in the sense of my periods weren't irregular. I wasn't having hot sweats.
So how do you feel about prescribing it then for women who are still having periods and still relatively normal, if you want an inverted commas?
Well, I think they have lots of symptoms. Like, I felt my brain wasn't as sharp. You know, I'm a GP. You know, I see patients throughout the day. I can't afford to not be sharp.
No, we can't afford you not to be sharp either.
You know, I need to be on the ball, and I don't want to be grumpy either with my patients. Mm. So, you know, for me, that my decision was based on the fact that I had brain fog, like a lot of women say, not able to concentrate, feeling really fatigued and tired, and feeling low, actually. Yeah. You know, I did feel really low. I mean, I know one might say, oh, you've lost your father. But yes, there's a difference, I think, in how your mood is. When you're going through the menopause, you do feel low. That doesn't mean to say you still can't feel bereavement and grief. Those are two separate things. And we do have estrogen receptors in our brain. So one of the things is, you know, when our estrogen levels are fluctuating, on the days that maybe they're not so high, then I think people probably feel more moody. And that's what we talk about when we have labile mood. You know, that's why
women... Labile mood. I've never heard that expression. What does that mean?
It means fluctuating mood. That mood can vary. You know, you can feel tearful quite quickly.
No, so, my girlfriend has said that to me, suddenly bursting into tears for something so small, so minor.
Yeah, so it's labile mood. So you know, you can cry watching a programme that you normally wouldn't normally cry at, you know, sort of watching some animals and things. I mean, I'm not an animal lover personally, and I can sit there sort of getting all a bit teary about it. So, you know, your mood, you're out of control.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of women say that they feel out of control.
But that's very worrying if that's happening in your mid-40s when you're still having periods. You're definitely not likely to connect back to, oh, this must be a menopausal or perimenopausal symptom, this is why I'm feeling a bit low. You know, it's a time of our lives when we're so busy. We're, you know, we may have children, we may have difficult stages of our careers, we may be the sandwich generation where we're looking after older parents and younger offspring. Mm. And of course we're stressed, of course we're busy, and of course our moods are going to shift.
I think women put it down to that, you know, we're spinning so many plates, you know, we're juggling so many things. Exactly as you said, you know, you have children, you know, some might be going off to university, you've got sort of elderly parents that you're sort of caring, looking after. You're also probably at a point in your career that you're making lots of different changes. And I've had women giving up high-powered careers at this point. You know, I had a woman who worked in the city who decided that she was going to give that up because it was far too stressful, and she went off and did ceramics. I mean, she's enjoying it, but she's not making the money that she was making. And you just think, well, you know, and she's missing that aspect of her life. Yeah. So I think, you know, that we need to raise more awareness.
I was going to say, what kind of reaction, you know, could you expect if you went to your GP in your mid-40s and said, oh, I've got a busy life, but my mood is low?
I think a lot of GPs may automatically dish out antidepressants. And I think that's a really sad thing. And I think it goes back to the fact that I think that a lot of GPs or a lot of doctors imagine that a woman going through this time in her life or going through the menopause is a more older, probably a less glamorous woman. And, you know, I'm not that kind of woman at all, you know, and I think
you are
that...
You're very glam.
Thank you. And I think that, you know, we need to raise awareness that it can be, you know, sort of women in their mid-40s or from 40 onwards.
Well, interesting, especially, is that women from Asian, Pakistani backgrounds, is that more relevant for them? Because I know there'll be lots listening.
It is more relevant for them, and I think it's more relevant from the point of fertility as well. So if people are thinking that they want to have children, maybe they need to be thinking a bit sooner rather than thinking we can wait.
Why
until 40.
Why is that the difference? Is it in cultural? Is it genetic? Is it foods that are being eaten?
I think it's a number of factors. I think nutrition may be an important factor there. I think Also, there does tend to be a lot of polycystic ovarian syndrome, you know, and insulin resistance and diabetes, type 2 diabetes within the Southeast Asian community. So I think those are also factors involved there. And it may just be, you know, sort of hereditary factors within, you know, certain races. You know, for example, the Japanese women don't tend to have as many symptoms as we do here in the West.
Although I have heard it's due to underreporting.
That's what I was going to say. I think maybe they are less reporting because maybe they're not tolerating, not the right word, but I think they're putting up with it probably in a way.
Yes, culturally it's not acceptable at all to talk about it.
Absolutely.
So you wouldn't even admit it to your best friend or your doctor, let alone
why. And that's why I think awareness needs to be raised across the board, not just in the Southeast Asian community, I think across all sort of ethnicities, that, you know, start to think about if you are feeling this way in your 40s, go and discuss it with your GP. And it may be that it might be to do with your perimenopause. There may be other factors, but sure. I think we need to look into it rather than just writing off a woman at that point in time.
And at what point would you not ever prescribe HRT? Because I know that there will be some people listening who'll be thinking, well, that's fine, but I've got a history of breast cancer, or my mother died of breast cancer. You know, at what point do you say, actually, I'm really sorry, but this isn't for you?
I think if there is a history of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer,
Close would that have to be? Would that be like your mother or your sister?
I mean, if you've got a history of estrogen receptor breast cancer, I wouldn't prescribe it.
No. Although you can take it vaginally, can't you?
You can.
So localised. Yeah.
Because it's very local. It's a very low dose. So you can still take it locally. And I think,
even if you've had an estrogen receptor breast cancer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the other thing is, if you have got the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 genes, then I think, you know, you have an 85% chance, up to an 85% chance of developing a breast cancer. So probably I wouldn't be prescribing it to you as well.
But what about if somebody said, well, my mother had breast cancer?
Depends how old she is. I mean, if she was in her 60s or 70s, that doesn't automatically put you at a higher risk. I think people assume that if one of their sort of relatives has had breast cancer, they automatically can't have HRT. But I think you need to understand that if a relative has had breast cancer in their 60s or 70s, actually that's just the same as the normal population risk.
Reasonably high likelihood of developing it then anyway.
Yes. Yeah. And I wouldn't be putting that down to a genetic cause. That would be just a normal baseline risk as the population would have it. Yes. Yeah.
And then in terms of other cancers, are there other estrogen receptive cancers other than breast cancer?
There's ovarian cancer.
Right.
So with ovarian cancer, obviously we need to know a bit more about you and put the risks into perspective. It's not as straightforward as with breast cancer, and I think, you know, I would need to spend a little bit more time finding out more.
Yeah. And for those women who absolutely can't take it, is there any alternative?
There are sort of herbal remedies out there, like Promensal, which is some natural sort of estrogens in there. There are other.
But if they're estrogens, should they be taking them even if they're, you know,
yes, I mean
natural?
they're more herbal, you know, so they're not going to feed into any kind of breast cancer or ovarian cancer risk. So no. The other things that they can take if they're getting hot flushes are, funnily enough, going back to antidepressants, the SSRIs, really well. Like venlafaxine works really well for hot flushes.
So it depends on your symptoms then, but there is hope. There are interventions that you can have.
And so you need to discuss that with each individual, and, you know, they need to be informed. And a lot of women, I mean, I've had women who have had breast cancer and things say, we really want to go onto it, back onto our HRT, because they felt good on it. So sometimes we have to say no. And, you know, I'm quite happy to say no at times, because you have to think about the bigger picture and you think, well, what are the other alternatives you can offer? Yeah. But at the end of the day, I think sometimes we underestimate. A woman is an intelligent person. She can make her own decisions. She can make an informed choice. And I, as a doctor, am there to help her through that journey, not to force any HRT on her or force any other medication on her. And it's down to her then to make that decision ultimately with you.
Do you know, it's really interesting to say that, because I familiarised myself yet again recently by reading the NICE guidelines.
Okay.
And it's very clear when you read those that it is the woman's choice.
Absolutely.
It's what the woman who is presenting as a patient would like to do.
Yes.
It's if she would like to stay on it, if she would like to take it, if she would like to come off it. You know, it's very much, it's not this dictatorial, oh, finger wagging, you must do this or you mustn't do that.
And there is, and in the NICE guidelines, there's no cut-off point. It doesn't say 5 years or 10 years. And I think that's another thing that we need to put out there. Mm-hmm. There isn't a time limitation on when you stop HRT.
You could take it forever if you wanted.
You could take it forever. We may need to adjust the dose because your needs for it may not be the same when you were 65 as you were when you were 55.
Right.
And so dosages may need to be changed, adjusted, reduced. But overall, you know, you can stay on it. You know, I had a 72-year-old woman who her GP had sent to me to sort of say about stopping her HRT. And I had a lovely discussion with her. And she said to me, but I've only got married 2 years ago. I don't want to have vaginal dryness right now. And I thought,
fabulous.
Good on you. And I said, but maybe you don't need as much of it as you need,
right.
as you had before.
Right.
So we negotiated a reduction in dose.
Yeah.
You know, and she was very happy with that.
And what type do you prescribe or recommend? Because again, coming back to where it comes from, in the old days, it seemed to Premarin was the one that was coming from pregnant horses' urine,
yes.
which is really not very pleasant. Whereas now the gels and patches are all derived from wild yams. Is
yes,
that right?
Yes.
So what's the sort of thing that you're prescribing?
I mean, I prefer prescribing the gels and the patches and the natural micronized progesterone, utrogestan. But however, that doesn't mean to say I rule out tablets totally. For mm-hmm. some women, it totally suits their lifestyle to be on a tablet. I mean, there are a couple that I really like to prescribe. You know, there's Femiston, which the progesterone in it doesn't increase your risk of breast cancer to significantly. So some women, because of their mm-hmm. lifestyle, they may be flying, they may be traveling, don't want to be putting gels and patches on.
Sure.
Some women don't want to put patches on. You know, a lot of women at this stage in their life are starting new relationships.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I've got a girlfriend who has a patch and she said it's a nicotine patch.
Okay, well, look, you know, I'm one of those women, you know, who's now single. So, I mean, I don't want to be having a patch on me to sort of, it kind of makes you feel a little bit unsexy. So lots of women like to be using gels or tablets because it wants more of an invisible type of HRT. And for them to feel like they, when they were younger, when they were taking the pill, the contraceptive pill.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it, talking about the contraceptive pill, because that, again, is quite a higher dose of hormones.
Oh, much higher, yes.
And yet there doesn't seem to be the scares and the anxiety around it.
I think when I am putting younger women onto the contraceptive pill, they don't seem to take as much notice about breast cancer risk and ovarian cancer.
Invincible.
I think they're just thinking about it more about the bigger picture. It's controlling their periods. They don't want to get pregnant. I think the biggest thing for them is not to get pregnant and regulating their periods and to be in control. And so they happily take it. And they're more worried about weight gain, you know, sort of greasy hair, spotty skin, rather than, you know, breast cancer risk or ovarian cancer risk. So, and I think there is an element of, you know, they're only young, so they do feel a bit invincible at that point in time. Yes, absolutely.
Very interesting. You mentioned earlier polycystic
ovarian syndrome.
Ovarian syndrome, and that is staggeringly common, isn't it? Is it 1 in 10 women,
women? I mean, it's more common than you think.
So describe it. What exactly is it?
So it's an imbalance of your hormones. And we're talking about hormones which are your estrogen, progesterone and testosterone. So it's an imbalance and you tend to have a little bit more testosterone. Hence, and also you have cysts on your ovaries. You don't have to have all of those things going on. It's usually 2 out of 3. And the visible symptoms of it tend to be acne, sort of being a bit more hirsute, as in hairy in your body.
Mm.
And most women do tend to be overweight. And however, there are also a group of women who tend to be underweight as well. So
it's tricky to tell then, isn't it?
Yeah. But they tend to be more overweight women. And a lot of the time, by a woman just reducing her weight by about 5%, it will help with getting her hormones in check. And the main feature is the reason that they tend to present is irregular periods or having periods which are really spaced out, sort of 40 days, you know, 30 days, 3 months. So there's no regular pattern. And hence we do the blood test and we usually do an ultrasound scan. And they tend to find it very hard to lose weight because their body's not responding to the insulin hormone to help them to mobilize fat and to utilize the carbohydrates that they're eating so well. So they're also at a higher risk of developing type 2 diabetes they're also at a higher risk of having high cholesterol and lipids. So they are an important sort of group of women, because a lot of them come in feeling quite low. They're struggling to lose weight.
Mm. Well, 1 in 10 is a high number.
It's a really high number, you know.
And at what age do they tend to come and see you? Are they coming in young, or are they coming in older as a last resort?
No, actually, I see a lot of them, as you mentioned before, you know, although I'm London-based, I used to work in Oxford a lot, so I used to look after a lot of the students in some of the colleges. So I used to see them from the age of sort of 17, 18 to 25, 26. Mm. So a lot of them come in at that point in time. And surprisingly, there was a sort of a high pickup rate from these, you know, sort of young women coming in. Funnily enough, then these women also tend to go through similar symptoms when they're going through the perimenopause, because of the weight gain that starts to happen because of the hormonal changes. And even women who haven't had polycystic ovarian syndrome, they start to mimic a similar picture in their 40s because of the fluctuating hormones. Mm. And that's why they start to feel a bit low, because they're struggling with losing weight because their body shapes start to change.
Gosh, there's all such a complex little jigsaw going on
it
inside,
really is.
Isn't it?
Well, that's what, you know, well, we women are like that. They are a bit more complicated creatures, really.
And it's also fascinating. Is acne a sort of an early warning sign of that? If you're somebody that had acne going through puberty, or perhaps you've got a daughter or granddaughter with acne, is it something that you think, oh, maybe there could be something else going on?
I think if they've got really a lot of acne, but I think it's a combination of acne, maybe sort of facial hair, irregular periods. If somebody came in like that, I mean, I've got to a point now that when somebody walks in through the door, I can almost guess that they've got it. Yes.
Yeah. And how do you treat it?
Put them on the contraceptive pill when they're younger.
Right.
I mean, another thing is using, it's an off-license indication, but sometimes we use diabetic medication like metformin, because metformin will help to increase insulin sensitivity, help them to lose weight, and by losing weight that brings their hormones back into check again, and their periods back to being regular.
Now, you do quite a lot, I know, in your clinic with weight management. What are your sort of top tips that are your absolutely irrefutable must do's or mustn't do's?
Well, number one, I will always say to a woman to look at her diet and really cut back on the carbohydrates. I mean, as I said before, I do love my croissants. I'm not saying you don't have to have them ever, but maybe really think about your protein to carb balance and increase the protein aspect of your diet.
So what sort of percentage then, if we're looking in daily terms, of daily foods?
I'd be thinking that you would have maybe sort of 25% carbs, about sort of 50% protein, and 25% vegetables. So really thinking about it in that kind of way.
So in your carbs, you're including obviously the obvious things like sugars and cakes and things, but also things like white rice and pasta and bread.
I try and say to people to have more what we call low glycemic index foods. So the kind of carbohydrates that are going to release sugars slowly over time. So try and avoid white rice, white bread, you know, sort of sugary foods.
But you can have a bit of brown rice?
Brown rice, brown bread, you know, seeded breads. The other things are, you know, once in a while, it's fine to have sort of cakes and biscuits. Let's not sort of
birthday cake or something.
Yes, you know, let's not make life a bit glum. You know, if you like that kind of thing, then go for it sometimes. Yeah. But it's all about getting balance and moderation.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to exercise. And I'm not going to say that you have to be doing an hour every single day. You know, I often say to women, what about putting some music on and just dancing, you know?
Nothing like
really
a good
moving.
Old dance, isn't it? Yeah, I'm always really pleased actually when I go to a party and they put some music on and gives you an excuse to kind of dance off some of the glasses of wine that you might have.
But it's also important to do some strength exercises using weights, because the other thing that tends to happen around this time as well for a woman going through the menopause is she loses muscle mass. So that's why body shapes change. So you get round around the middle, then you have these sort of stick arms and stick legs almost. That's because we're losing muscle. So it's not just good enough just to go and just do some aerobic exercise, pick up some weights, you know, or use your own body.
So things like push-ups, where you're using your own body
and
resistance.
Squats. So push-ups and squats.
Which anybody can do.
Yeah, and you don't need to go out and buy a whole set of weights.
No kit, no equipment, even any special clothing.
So I often say, you know, push-ups, if you're having to choose, push-ups and squats are really good, because squats really build a lot of muscle around your legs. And actually, when you've got muscle helps to burn your fat, so you'll tend to not put on so much weight as well.
So your metabolism will increase.
Absolutely.
The musclier you are. Fab. Yeah. Last note, alcohol. We've touched on it before. Presumably that is a carbohydrate.
It is.
So, you know, give us some good news. Let's end on a positive. What can we do?
Well, look, I think it's about moderation, you know, and we hear about for cardiovascular disease, having a glass of red wine is a positive. I mean, I always say to people to have 2 alcohol-free nights per week, give your liver a rest.
Should they be consecutive, do you think?
No, I usually say a bit like the 5-2 diet, space them out.
Yeah.
And so that's really a good thing to do. And the other thing is, you know, just moderate.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say no, you know, if you enjoy it, have some, but, you know, moderate, 1 to 2 glasses. That's about it, I would say.
Excellent. I love the fact, Shazadi, that you never say no. That's great. Now, you have a clinic that's opening in London, which is really exciting.
I am.
That's going to be opening in the autumn of 2018.
Yes, it will be at number 39 Harley Street, and it's going to be the Good Menopause Clinic.
Fantastic.
And I will be there.
Excellent. Well, having written the Good Gut Guide, yes, and the Good Menopause Guide, I shall definitely be dropping in. So thank you. Now, it's great to chat. That does bring us to a close for today. Thank you so much for being with us. Now, we are going to be putting, as always, all the details and links and resources on our podcast notes. So I will pick up with Shazadi after this particular recording and make sure that we capture everything that we've talked about, including details of her clinics, details of all the strategies, weight loss ideas, all the hormonal treatments and support groups as well, perhaps for some of the things that we've talked about, in particular breast cancer, osteoporosis and PCOS. Now, do remember that if you'd like to catch the next episode, it's always worth clicking the subscribe button on your podcast app, because that ensures that the next episode gets downloaded automatically, safely to your gadget, so you don't even have to think about it. And if you can, do please leave a review, as it really helps others to find us. And we do know that listening to podcasts is actually one of the best ways to spread good information about helpful things on health and well-being that really do matter. So you can also sign up on lizellewellbeing.com for the newsletters, that we have lots more wellbeing wisdom and insights and a few photos and behind the scenes snaps as well. So until the next time we chat, go well. Bye bye.